This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest today, journalist Kai Strittmatter, says while Americans worry a lot about the threat Russia poses to the United States, the real challenge to liberal democracy will come not from a stagnant Russia, but from the authoritarian economic powerhouse of China. Strittmatter speaks fluent Mandarin and has studied China for more than 30 years. In a new book, he warns that the regime of Chinese President Xi Jinping has embraced an ideological rigidity unknown since the days of Mao Zedong and a level of control over its population that is simply unprecedented. Strittmatter describes an astonishing level of surveillance exercised by the Chinese state over its citizens, generating massive databases used to punish people for even minor deviations from expected norms of behavior. And he says China is aggressively using its state-controlled technology firms to infiltrate and influence Western institutions and is marketing its authoritarian system as a model for other nations to follow. Kai Strittmatter was the China correspondent for more than a decade for the Deutsche Zeitung, one of Germany's largest newspapers. He now works in Copenhagen. His new book is We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. He joins me from his home in Copenhagen. Kai Strittmatter, welcome to Fresh Air. There's a big investment in China in facial recognition technology and a lot of cameras. I mean, these numbers are incredible that you quoted. 2016, there were 176 million surveillance cameras in the country. It's a big country, but that's a lot. And then you say as many as 600 million surveillance cameras now. Tell us what kind of capability this presents. Where do all these pictures go? How are they used?
Yeah, so that's the difference to before, right? I mean, I'm a German, you know. We had the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and then we were actually one of the few countries, I would say, where you actually could study, and you still can study, the means and instruments of dictatorship, of the arms of the dictatorship. We have a state security museum of the former Eastern German state security. And one of the lessons that historians have taken from that is actually they were overwhelmed by the mass of data that they actually collected, by their own paranoia. Now, with new information technology, you know, this is suddenly changing because you're no longer having real people sitting. There's no policeman sitting behind these cameras, you know, at a screen and watching them and trying to watch, like, you know, a whole bunch of policemen trying to watch 10,000 cameras. Instead, you have algorithms. You have artificial intelligence actually working there, and that makes it much more effective. So, for example, already in 2018, you know, if you're asking what have they achieved already, in 2018, the People's Daily, which is the party's central newspaper, it claimed on Twitter — Twitter is forbidden inside China, but they still use it for propaganda purposes. So you can see they're very proud of these achievements also. So they claimed on Twitter that already now their Skynet — this is what they're calling this network of surveillance camera, Skynet, like the one in the Terminator. I don't know whether you've seen the movies. Their Skynet is already capable of identifying each and every single one of their 1.4 billion citizens in the course of 1 second.
What does that mean, to identify them all in 1 second? What is that describing?
That means if you're looking for someone and you have his or her picture in your database, and you feed that picture in your database, and you tell the algorithm, or you ask the algorithm, you ask the computer to tell you the moment once this person is actually stepping on the street, that what you — once they're stepping outside of their home and getting into the reach of one of those surveillance cameras, it doesn't take more than 1 second that the computer will actually alarm you. They're here and there, and you can go and pick them up there.
You are never alone. Wow.
You are never alone, exactly. But a question back then, you know, is it even true? And then very soon you realize it doesn't even matter whether it's true or not, as long as people believe it. This is a very important point, you know, because what the Communist Party is doing with all these high-tech surveillance technology now is they're trying to internalize control, you know? They're trying to make people self-censor themselves much more than they used to do. And once, you know, you believe it's true, it's like you don't even need the policeman at the corner anymore because you're becoming your own policeman.
Information is gathered from other methods besides, of course, all of these surveillance cameras. And that's a lot of that is the digital footprints that Chinese citizens leave. You write that most purchases in China are now digital. Even street beggars use barcodes to collect handouts. This is true. What do they use?
At least in Beijing, they're doing it, you know, because everybody has been asking for a long time the question, can authoritarian regimes actually be innovative, you know? And I think China, up to a certain point, has proved, of course, they can, you know, in terms of, like, for example, fintech applications or the apps they use on their daily mobile phones. They're really, in some sense, much more advanced to anything that we use. There's this one app on every Chinese mobile phone that's called WeChat. And with WeChat, basically, you can live your whole life. It started as a normal chat program like WhatsApp, but very soon it turned into a kind of Chinese Facebook. Then it became a Chinese Uber. You could apply for credit to your bank with it. You could use it as an ID, actually. You could file your divorce papers through this app. And you can do all your financial transactions through this app. And that works with barcodes. And they've been using these barcodes for a long time already. I mean, I left China 2 years ago, but it's been a thing of 4 and 5 years. You know, the Chinese, when they look at us, and some of my Chinese friends, they go traveling to Europe and they come back and say, oh, it's beautiful in Europe and it's so romantic. But really, I mean, you're so far behind us, you know, it's really, I can't believe how advanced we are already technologically compared to you. You know, it's so convenient what we can do with our apps and everything. And when they talk about cashless payment, you know, I'm living in Scandinavia now. There's also cashless payment is the main form of payment. I think 80%, 90% of all transactions are done cashless here. But in Denmark, in Sweden, in Norway, cashless payment means you use your credit card. Most of the times, nobody in China uses credit cards. Nobody has been using them for years. Everybody does everything with their mobile phones, you know? And so you come to the point that even street beggars use them, and they will tell you, it's so convenient. How come you don't use it? Of course it's convenient. It's amazingly convenient, but at the same time, is also amazingly convenient for state security. And every single one of your transactions will actually end up on one of their servers.
Right. So WeChat is, you know, it's a payment service, kind of like Venmo. You can transfer money. It's a social media platform. It's a messaging app. It's all these other things.
Exactly.
And the government extracts all this information about you. What's been your experience in terms of seeing how citizens feel the presence of the state through information they get from this WeChat app?
I mean, the thing is, you know, Chinese citizens have, they've been used to that. They feel the presence of the state. They've been feeling the presence of the state for all their lives. And I had some friends who actually, they were in the end, I mean, you realize it sometimes when some of your chats are being censored, you know, suddenly words or sentences are missing. That's like the first step before they delete your account or anything, and they never reach the other party, or you don't actually get part of the conversation that your friends send you. This is like something that many Chinese experience. But then on the next level, it gets, you know, if you're like politically interested, if you're maybe a little bit in the activist line. I had some friends like this, and I actually had two of them getting arrested because of their WeChat records, because they had actually on WeChat agreed with other people, with friends, to go to a poetry reading where a poet in Beijing was supposed to read some poems supporting the students in Hong Kong in their struggle for democracy. And they never made it to the poetry reading. They were arrested on the way. And it was clearly because of their WeChat conversations. And actually, I myself had the same experience. I had like appointments with friends for interviews, but like this one guy we agreed to meet in a hotel, in a Beijing hotel, via WeChat. And I got there, and like after half an hour, I get a message from him, this time not on WeChat, but on through the iPhone messaging app. And he tells me, "I'm sorry I'm late. I'm sure you understand why." And of course, I immediately knew why. And later then he told me that state security had called him immediately after they saw our appointment on WeChat and told him and threatened him not to come and see me.
So you've told us about the incredible amount of data that the Chinese security authorities harvest on Chinese citizens, from facial recognition cameras and tracking their purchases and everything else. And how this is used is remarkable. You write about these experiments in social control in which people are constantly evaluated for their honesty and conformity to social norms. You write that this was spurred in part by Xi Jinping's concern when he came into power that a breakdown of trust in the country was a threat to economic growth. You want to explain this a bit? What kind of dishonesty was threatening the economic health of the country?
Yes, so the thing with China is, as with all authoritarian system, is there is really, societies are not really healthy, you know. So the societies in authoritarian systems always are sick societies. And one of the main reasons is because there is no trust. This is not new. This is not something new for China. This has been like this in dictatorships for centuries and millennia. But in China, it's an especially big problem because of the Cultural Revolution, because that was such a catastrophic event. That was 10 years under Mao Zedong, 1966 to 1976, where, you know, this was the time when China was really a totalitarian country. And this was a time where actually the great leader, Mao Zedong, he actually had children reporting on their parents and husbands reporting on their wives, actually sending them to labor camps, you know, for just one word, one sentence they said. And having them killed, having them executed. Actually, that was one of the stories I did, was a guy who's a lawyer now. When he was 16 years old, he had his own mother executed because he reported her to the authorities because of a sentence she said while they were having dinner, where she said she preferred the old president over Mao Zedong. And he wrote a letter to the local revolutionary committee asking them to actually, literally asking them, he said she deserves death for that. And actually she was executed a couple of weeks later. So that was Mao Zedong. That was the time under Mao Zedong. And when you have a system like this, of course, trust is completely breaks down. You know, even the most intimate relationships are destroyed. So when Xi Jinping came to power, this was really, I think he thought it was one of his main missions that he had to do, was to address this crisis of trust and to bring trust back again, not only because he needed it for his own party, but also because this level of distrust is really a big hurdle for economic development.
So you write about these programs in various cities around China in which citizens are rated upon their honesty or creditworthiness. One of them is in a city called Rongqing, if I have the pronunciation right. You want to explain how this works?
Yes, Rongqing basically was one of the pilot programs that the Communist Party had set up in different cities for this social credit system. And Rongqing was the one that was constantly rated number one among all the pilot programs. And I had been speaking to people in Beijing, and one of them told me, a professor who was an advisor for the system, he said, "You have to go to Rongqing and visit the Office of Honesty." And that's already, you know, a name like a really George Orwell name, the Office of Honesty. So I went there to have a look at the social credit system there. And there it's actually really like right out of a picture book. Every citizen in Rongqing starts with a score of 1,000 points. And then you can work your way up. You can get more points by doing really good things for society, and you can fall down. You know, they also actually they copied a little bit the Wall Street model. They can rate you if you have more than 1,050 points. You can be a triple A citizen, and then you become a double A citizen if you fall lower, and C and D. If you're a D citizen, you're actually dishonest and you have less than 599 points.
So how do you get or lose points? What kind of activities get you in trouble or get you more points?
So, for example, you can earn points if you donate blood or bone marrow, or if you give lessons to the neighbor's children that they need for school. Or I went to a neighborhood where one lady, she got 5 points because she actually provided one of her basement rooms for the local choir that sang revolutionary songs then in there. At the same time, you get punished for the things that you're not supposed to do. And you can get punished for, you know, jaywalking. You can get punished for downloading pirated stuff. You can get punished for letting your dog poo on the lawn in front of the neighborhood, for all these kinds of things. So many of these things would be actually actions that we also consider them, you know, not to be good actions and maybe, you know, worthy of being punished. But of course, then it goes much further and it also becomes political.
And when your score starts falling and you regard it as a disreputable citizen, what are the consequences?
What we have to actually say is that they're introducing the system step by step now. It's not yet a nationwide system, and we'll have to see how it develops in the next couple of years. But one thing is already nationwide, and that's the system of blacklists. You know, if you're blacklisted because your social credit is down, then actually you already get sanctioned. For example, you're no longer allowed to take a plane. You're no longer able to buy plane tickets. You're no longer allowed to take a high-speed railway. You're no longer allowed, for example, inexpensive hotels. Your children are no longer allowed to go to expensive good schools and things like this. And this is something that's already happening. This is one part of the system that is already active. In 2018, there were more than 17 million people being banned from flying because of the system.
Public shaming is part of this too, right? I think you described a circumstance in which there's a surveillance camera, and if it catches you jaywalking, your face pops up on a little electronic billboard so everybody knows.
Exactly. That's happening in some cities, in Shenzhen, for example, in the south, or in Shenyang in the northeast. You have these billboard systems and cameras, artificial intelligence cameras. When you jaywalk, while you are still in the middle of the road, your face appears on the huge billboard for everybody to see. And next to your face, your name appears. Your ID number, part of it is blackened then so that people, you know, cannot see the whole thing. But the whole point is we know who you are. This is you, and you are actually hurting society this moment right now. So public shaming is a big part of it. Yes.
I'm wondering how Chinese citizens regard this. I mean, I don't know that there are reliable opinion polls. And I would imagine some people like the idea that, you know, that there's more control and crime is probably reduced. How do people react? Is there outrage? Is there depression? Is there suicide? What are you seeing?
You know, one thing I took away from China is one lesson I learned is that propaganda works, censorship works. And people actually believe a lot of the things that they heard because they don't have any other information. Also because there is no public debate on many of these things, you know. There is no tradition of public debate on privacy, data protection, and things like this. And the arguments of the government are basically twofold. One is convenience. It makes your life so convenient. And the second thing is it makes our life safer. This is especially what they use for the facial recognition and the cameras. And we actually make your life safe and secure. And you can go through the city. You can leave your handbag now in a bus and in a subway train, and nobody will dare take it. And they're right, probably. And many people buy that, and they like that.
I'm wondering if you're seeing generational differences in Chinese citizens' response to what's going on. I mean, there are people who lived through Mao's era. There are some around who remember the China before the revolution in 1949. And then, of course, some people are quite young. What differences are you seeing among how people respond to these initiatives?
Of course, you have critical people in China. You have a lot of, people who think a lot, who reflect a lot. But most of these people actually belong to a generation that has witnessed the crimes and sins of the Communist Party themselves, especially the generations who have lived through the Cultural Revolution and the generation who has lived through Tiananmen Square, the massacre near Tiananmen Square. Those are the people I found who are actually the most critical ones, because they have seen, you know, of what they think is the true nature of a system like this, the true nature of a party like this, you know. And young people, because propaganda is very successful and the sort of collective amnesia that the party wants to rule is very successful, people don't know. Even in Beijing, people don't speak and they don't know about the Tiananmen massacre, which is, you know, which was only happened, has had been happening in 1989. You know, remember, 2 million Beijingers were on the streets marching. Of course, this generation, they all know, but they were afraid to tell the children, because, you know, what do you do when your child in school suddenly tells the teacher and asks the teacher about Tiananmen massacre? Then you've got serious problems. So they're a lot more open for actually, you know, the propaganda, the party propaganda, as long as the party delivers, as long as their material life is still good, and as long as they're safe and wealthy. And at the moment, I would say, you know, this propaganda works especially well because, as I said, the party points to the United States and asks their people, would you rather want to live there? And actually many of the urban population and the younger ones at the moment are saying, no, we prefer probably China. But that only works as long as the economy is actually in good shape.
Well, Kai Strittmatter, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Kai Strittmatter is a journalist who's reported on and studied China for more than 30 years. His new book is We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. In the new psychological thriller, The Little Things, Denzel Washington and Rami Malek play two detectives trying to solve a series of murders in 1990s Los Angeles. Jared Leto also stars as one of their key suspects. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review of the movie, which is now streaming on HBO Max.
It's been a while since I've seen a new studio picture like The Little Things, a big, meaty, slickly made crime drama featuring a trio of Academy Award winners. That's partly due to COVID-19, which caused theaters to close 10 months ago and led the studios to postpone some of their biggest titles. But even if there weren't a pandemic, and The Little Things had been widely released in theaters as planned, it might still have played like a relic from an earlier movie-making decade. That's exactly what it is. The 90s were something of a renaissance era for serial killer movies, and the director, John Lee Hancock, wrote this script back in 1993, 2 years after The Silence of the Lambs, and 2 years before David Fincher's notorious shocker, Seven. It's interesting to think how The Little Things might have fit into the genre if it had been made back then. But for various reasons, even though Steven Spielberg and Clint Eastwood both considered directing it, the movie never got off the ground. It was revived only a few years ago, now with Hancock in the director's chair. He appears to have made few changes to his script, which is still set in the 90s, probably because so much of the story depends on payphones. Denzel Washington plays Joe Deacon, also known as Deke, a former Los Angeles detective who now works as a sheriff's deputy in Bakersfield. But on a work-related trip down to L.A., he meets up with his old friends on the force and gets pulled into a major case. His unlikely partner is a young hotshot named Jim Baxter, played by Rami Malek. In typical buddy cop fashion, they get off on the wrong foot, but soon settle into a comfortable groove, with Deke playing the grizzled mentor to Baxter's ambitious up-and-comer. They're trying to solve the murders of several young women, the latest of whom has been found in a rundown flophouse, one of many reminders here of an older, less gentrified Los Angeles. The police make a thorough sweep of the scene, but it's Deke who finds the evidence that leads them to a repairman, Albert Sparma, who becomes their prime suspect. He's played by Jared Leto, who sports long, stringy hair and a prosthetic nose, and who gives a performance of such calculated creepiness he might as well be wearing an arrest me sign. In one scene, Deke is snooping around a car one night outside Sparma's apartment when the man himself suddenly appears.
Can I help you?
I saw the for sale sign.
That was for another car.
Got a lot of miles on it. You a salesman?
No.
How's the trunk space?
Standard.
Mind if I take a look? I'm in the market.
It's not for sale.
All I need to do is take a look.
You must really like my car.
I do.
But while Sparma may look like their man, Deke and Baxter have a hard time finding the evidence that would prove it. It's never clear if Sparma is the culprit or just a true crime buff who enjoys toying with the police. Over time, the uncertainty begins to eat away at Baxter, in much the same way it once ate away at Deke, who left the LAPD years ago after another unsolved case nearly drove him mad. If the Little Things has an obvious kinship with Seven, it also seems to anticipate another David Fincher triumph, Zodiac, in which a criminal investigation becomes a corrosive personal obsession. The script has its creaky, tin-eared moments. I could have done with fewer of Deke and Baxter's strained wisecracks, and there's something a little obvious about their gradual realization of how similar they are under the skin. The forensic details are as familiar as they are gruesome. You've seen it all before, from the blood-spattered crime scenes and nude corpses on autopsy tables, to the wall of evidence covered with maps and photos. But it's worth remembering that Hancock conceived this story nearly 30 years ago, when these images weren't the clichés they are now. The Little Things may look like a retread, but it feels more like a time capsule, a weirdly enveloping trip down memory lane. I got wrapped up in its slowly unraveling twists and in the rapport between the two leads. Washington is all too convincing as a dogged crime solver who isn't afraid to go rogue when needed. He's also one of the few movie stars, of course, who's as popular now as he was in the 90s. Hancock himself has come a long way since then. He has a sturdy command of craft, as he's demonstrated in the other movies he's directed, like The Blind Side and Saving Mr. Banks. The Little Things tells a much darker story, but Hancock proves a better fit than you might think. He's good at quickening your pulse, and his attention to details, the little things of the title, slowly draws you in. There's nothing comforting about this grim, existentially unsettling movie, but its patient old-school pleasures provide their own kind of satisfaction.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed The Little Things, now streaming on HBO Max. There are a lot of things we take for granted, and among them are our voices. We sing, we laugh, we yell at ballparks, and we talk all the time, on the phone, in the office, on street corners, in noisy bars, and in doing so, we can damage our voices. Our guest, writer John Colapinto, has his own experience with that, which you'll soon hear about, and he became interested in the voice, which is the subject of his new book. It's an exploration of the astonishing complexity of our vocal apparatus, and of how we form words, how babies learn to speak, how accents arise, and how different kinds of voices affect us, which ones sound authoritative or sexually appealing or politically persuasive. And Colapinto argues that the development of our prehistoric ancestors' vocal structures may have been the key to humans becoming the dominant species on the planet. John Colapinto is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's the author of the best-selling nonfiction book As Nature Made Him and the novel About the Author. He joins me from his home in New York City to talk about his new book, This Is the Voice. Well, John Colapinto, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
I thought we would begin with the story that you tell in the book early. When you're 41 years old, I think, working at Rolling Stone magazine, and the publisher, Jan Wenner, is putting together a sort of an ad hoc rock band for a big staff party and asks you to be the lead singer. Had you done any singing?
I had, actually. I had been singing since high school, just kind of casually. I sang in my school choir and so on. I played piano in coffee houses in college. So I was, you know, I could carry a tune. I even knew what projection was, sort of making the voice big and filling a room with it. But I had never done any proper vocal warm-ups. And that's how I got into trouble when I was singing with Jan Wenner's rock band with Rolling Stone magazine. I was, at the time, finishing a book, actually As Nature Made Him, which you just mentioned. And I was being silent all day long. I would jump up at the end of the day, take the subway to our rehearsal space, and then just start wailing over their cranked up guitars and drums. I mean, 0 to 60 with my voice, just crazy. Anyone that knows anything about singing, proper singing, knows you don't do that. And I quickly developed a rasp and sort of hoarseness, which I'd had in the past and had cleared up. This didn't. And in fact, we rehearsed for weeks, and then we had the performance itself, which was highly nerve-wracking. And when you're nervous, muscles tense up, you strain extra hard. So I was sort of triply damaging my voice. Later learned that it was I have a vocal polyp, which is started by a bleeding vocal cord.
Right. Yeah, and you describe it in one of the rehearsals. Rolling Stone was a pretty hot commodity then, and the lead singer for the Jay Giles Band drops by and hears you singing in rehearsal and gives you a little advice.
Yeah. He pulled me aside and said, "Hey, man, you don't have to sing full out in rehearsal. Save something for the show." And he was actually doing a guest song with us, and I saw how he was doing it. I mean, just, you know, he was kind of quarter power. Very, very smart, and I've never forgotten it.
Right. But it was new to you, and so you get to the concert and you don't quite have the range that you did. You said it's kind of painful to listen to the tape from that, huh?
Deeply terrifying. I mean, there's nothing quite like the seconds and minutes ticking down to a performance in front of 2,000 people that include Yoko Ono and her son Sean and Paul Schaefer and Val Kilmer and countless others. And knowing that, you know, and knowing that there's something wrong with your voice. I mean, I was just saying, I think something's not going to go right here. A certain high note in one of the songs, Miss You by the Rolling Stones, had been really, really hard to get over the preceding days. And it was just terrifying. I mean, I remember getting up in the spotlight and thinking, oh, Lord, I just hope this all happens. And, you know, somehow I kind of got through the performance. But yeah, it's painful to listen to the CD because I can hear the tentativeness. And this is one of the things about the voice and performing with a voice. We hear, all of us actually, tentativeness. Just anyone slightly holding back. You can't get away with those types of things without people recognizing something's slightly amiss. So it makes me wonder how professionals do it. Especially people like opera singers who are being listened to so closely by people with acute critical skills. Terrifying.
Right. It is an instrument, which is, I guess, what your book is about.
Yes. Yes.
You have terrible laryngitis after the concert, and then you have this encounter in an elevator with a woman who just catches this right away. What does she tell you?
It was amazing. We were brand new in the building. I said to her, what floor, as one does in New York, you're going to push the button for someone. And those two words, she said, oh, you've got a serious voice injury. And I said, oh, it's nothing. It'll clear up. And she said, no, you know, I work with Broadway singers and so on. And she said, I know what I'm hearing. And she read me like a book. She said, you know, I bet you get kind of tired at the end of the day because you're using all your muscles. You're having to work harder with your back and your abs and your hip flexors. All of these muscles we use in order to actually push the air out when we speak. She even said, you know, I bet your neck gets pretty sore. And it had been burning, almost as if I had like scalded the skin. I mean, it was amazing. But the last thing she said to me was, you should at least get a laryngologist to look at that because it could be something else. I grew up in a medical family. Something else is the approved euphemism for cancer or some kind of dangerous growth. So I immediately made an appointment with one of the top vocal surgeons in the world, Peak Wu. He looked in my throat with a laryngology instrument and said, you've got a pretty major polyp, which is a bump on the edge of my vocal cord.
You ended up later on doing a story in The New Yorker about this very subject, vocal surgery, and with a doctor who had treated singers, who famous singers in some cases, who dealt with this. He took a look at you, saw this polyp. If you were to try and get this repaired, what would that entail?
It's quite remarkable what it would entail. I actually waited to, I guess it was 10 years after seeing Peak Wu when I initially injured myself, and I was doing that New Yorker story on Steven Zeitel's. And really, he not only explained to me what he would have to do, but I watched him do it to several patients of his. And what he does is he gets the person lying on their back, puts them unconscious, and also introduces a paralyzing agent to the entire body, because the slightest move while he's operating on a vocal cord will only make the matters worse, because he'll nick, you know, healthy tissue or something. But the person's lying on their back and their head is tilted back, and then this instrument is introduced down the throat that pries the vocal tract open. It's actually the weight of the body is used to kind of pry the whole vocal tract open, and he then reaches down the vocal tract, the throat, with these tiny scalpels and little devices for plucking at the flesh. And he's got them in both hands, and they're on like long knitting needle extensions that go down the throat. And he's looking through a stereo microscope that's aimed down there with a little light on it. And he's making these meticulously tiny movements with his fingers to do this astonishingly delicate surgery on these vocal cords. And when you remove a polyp, he slices delicately through the outer mucous membrane that covers all of our vocal cords. And in there is this little lump that interestingly doesn't need to be cut out. It can be sort of scooped out with a spoon-like instrument. And then once he's done that, he cannot sew the mucous membrane closed because it's too delicate. And so you, the patient, have to remain silent for 6 weeks afterwards so that everything can heal on its own. And that's my excuse, lame as it is, for never having had my polyp repaired. I just never saw the daylight for 6 weeks of vocal silence. Not to mention I'm a little bit scared of being operated on, but let's not admit that.
Well, that's quite an undertaking. And, you know, some well-known singers have had surgery like this. It hasn't always gone well, right?
Totally true. Actually, famously, Julie Andrews was the sort of super famous case when she was singing in Victor Victoria, a Broadway play. And she was known, I mean, I should have used her as the perfect example of the pellucid vocal tone with the clean, clean chopping of the air. I can't even imagine what her healthy vocal cords had looked like. But she developed a bleed while she was doing that show, and she went up to Mount Sinai. This was before Peak Wu's tenure there. And unfortunately, in the effort to remove the polyp, some healthy tissue evidently was removed as well. Because when she came out and did her 6 weeks of vocal science and then tried to speak and sing, lo and behold, she had a voice that was as bad or worse. And that happens. I mean, because it really is this exceedingly delicate surgery. Dr. Zeitel's actually, she went 2 years later and he tried to repair matters, but couldn't. Too much healthy tissue had been removed, as he put it to me. So yes, it's a big undertaking to do that.
You know, my voice matters in what I do. I mean, I talk on the radio, and I have over the years realized that I can't go to a ball game on the night before I go on the radio because I'm going to yell and I'm going to get raspy. I stay away from really noisy bars or restaurants because I find it just strains my voice, and pretty soon I'm speaking in a very low tone like that. So I guess a lot of us are walking around with some injury here, aren't we?
Absolutely. And I, you know, it's interesting you say that too, because I'm reminded of some things Itels told me, which is that it's by no means singers, which he calls vocal athletes, who get these injuries. People who talk a lot just because they're loquacious, you know, extroverts get it. School teachers get it heavily. So anyone that has a heavy vocal load in a given day is entirely susceptible to this. In other words, you don't have to be straining the voice, reaching a high note, or even yelling over crowds. You probably know this. You've probably had moments of raspiness where you were doing nothing more than speaking at a cocktail party or something. I mean, so I guess this goes to how very, very delicate the vocal cords are and how much we don't really think of that.
So you've written about your own experience, but then you've done a lot of research into different aspects of the voice, its evolution, its structure. So let's talk a bit about that. What makes the human voice different from those of other animals, which, you know, after all, have a wide variety of vocal communications, some of them kind of sophisticated?
Yeah, I mean, really the thing is our ability to shape the signal, that vocal signal, into the vowels and consonants that we then, you know, assemble into words and then structures that we call sentences, i.e. language. We do this thing where we're singing, but we're also shaping it into meaningful utterance. And no other animal can do that. It enables us to talk about what's going to happen tomorrow, what happened yesterday, what we hope to do 20 years from now, what we're worried about, and so on. Animals, for all the sophistication of their vocal signaling, and it is more sophisticated than I had realized, are really making in the now utterances and proclamations about how they feel, what, you know, threats, the urge to mate, and so on. They're kind of in the moment, but language permits us to talk about stuff that isn't there. And it allowed us to cooperate with each other in ways that ultimately permitted us to make things like cell phones and airplanes.
Before that, fire and, you know, agriculture and all that. Right. I mean, right. There's a lot that you can do when you can communicate it in a more sophisticated way.
Which was handy for a species that was slow running and not very strong and that could just be eaten by lions and other things.
I had no idea until I'd read the book about how complex the physical structures are in our mouths and throats that produce the sounds that we use in everyday language. You need your mouth and throat to act independently, right? Can you think of any, give us a little example of the ways in which this all comes together?
Well, that's exactly right. The really what we're doing is, when we speak, is we're creating a buzz in our throat. That air pulse thing I was talking about, as our vocal cords chop the air from our lungs, and that drone, this we can shape into A, E, I, O, U, which are the vowels of English, A, E, I, O, and U. But we also can do these cool things with our lips and tongue where we make noisy sounds like p, p, and t, and k. And all of those involve the tongue or lips making contact with each other or almost making contact when we say s or z. So we're making these noises that we're mixing with the singing-like tones of A, E, I, O, U. And as you point out, you know, things are acting independent of each other. I'm droning with my throat, but I'm arching and pushing forward my tongue for the vowels, but then I'm also hitting it and tapping it and doing all sorts of stuff to make the consonants, and then I'm timing all that in a way that puts together words and sentences. And we tend not to think of how remarkable that is.
Right. We get the buzz from our throat and then all these amazing little subtleties that produce consonants with our mouths. A P, you're not putting the buzz. A B, you're giving it a little buzz. And
I love that. Yeah, the voiced and unvoiced consonants. Absolutely. And the T and D are exactly the same gesture. What we also don't think of, almost more amazing, is that na is the same gesture as da and ta. Why does it sound different? Because there's a little trap door at the back of our throat, back of our palate, and we open that up for access to the nose, and we send the sound into the soft nasal passages, which turns da, ta into na, na, na. It's coming through the nose. And likewise, ma, which is just the ba sound, but ma, you're putting it through your nose incredibly. So I mean, the gymnastics of saying something as simple as give me the salt are just, it's kind of unimaginable.
You injured your voice when you were singing in a band among staff at the Rolling Stone when you were working there. You're now in another band. This is sort of coming full circle. Tell us about this.
Oh, yeah. The Sequoias. I was invited to join a New Yorker magazine in-house band. My fellow writer, John Seabrook, tapped me to do this. And I also play piano. So when I joined the band, it could have been 10 years ago now, I was determined to just play keyboards. I didn't want to further damage my voice. I knew I mustn't be naughty. But of course, within the first rehearsal, I was like demanding to sing some songs and just wanting to, because that, just that, the pleasure of it. I just love it. And so I just insisted on singing with the band. And, you know, I think that in doing that, I almost inevitably further damaged my voice, especially when we got sort of frightening high-profile gigs like the White House Correspondents' Dinner Jam, which we were invited to do 2 years in a row. Really exciting, but again, kind of nervous-making. And I sang in both of those jams and emerged probably with a more damaged voice, at least for singing.
Well, John Colapinto, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
John Colapinto is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is This Is the Voice.